this lecture entitled A Life of Sacrifice, the communities in Eretz Yisrael from the time of the destruction of the Beis HaMikdash, the temple, up until the conquest of the Crusaders, is dedicated to the honor and merit of Dr. and Mrs. Paul and Miri Zeidel and their children. For those who visit Eretz Yisrael today, a modern country that's bustling with agriculture, industry, and new building projects, one may forget that not too many years ago, the country was in such a state of ruin that Mark Twain, describing his trip there in the year 1867, was moved to write the following words. It's on your first page of your handout. We traverse some miles of desolate country whose soil is rich enough, but is given wholly to weeds, a silent, mournful expanse. And he continues, a desolation is here that not even imagination can grace with pomp of life and action. Reach Tabor safely, and further he writes, we never saw a human being on the whole route. We pressed on toward the goal of our crusade, renowned Jerusalem. The further we went, the hotter the sun got, and the more rocky and bare, repulsive and dreary the landscape became. And further he writes, Jerusalem is mournful, dreary, and lifeless. I would not desire to live here. It is a hopeless, dreary, heartbroken land. And further, there was hardly a tree or shrub anywhere. Even the olive and the cactus, those fast friends of worthless soil, had almost deserted the country. No landscape exists that is more tiresome to the eye than that which bounds the approaches to Jerusalem. And further, Palestine sits in sackcloth and ashes. Over it broods the spell of a curse that has withered its field and fettered its energies. And further, of all the lands there are for dismal scenery, I think Palestine must be the prince. The hills are barren, they're dull of color, they're unpicturesque in shape. The valleys are unsightly, deserts fringed with feeble vegetation that has an expression about it of being sorrowful and despondent. And further, every outline is harsh. Every feature is distinct. There's perspective. Distant works no enchantment here. It is a hopeless, dreary, heartbroken land. And further writes, Palestine is desolate and unlovely. Why should it be otherwise? Can the curse of the deity beautify a land? Palestine is no more of this workday world. It is sacred to poetry and tradition. It is dreamland. Even today, the length and breadth of the land is filled with mounds or tells, remnants of ancient cities that are now covered with the accumulated dust of thousands of years. By the way, on the whole, the area of the walled old city of Jerusalem was referred to in antiquity as the upper city, home to the aristocracy and the upper classes. During the end of the Second Temple period, it was occupied mainly by the Herodians and the Sadducees. That part of the city where the majority of Jews lived, those who were committed to the Torah, the area that housed hundreds of thousands, if not millions, is now covered in dust. The little that has been excavated bears witness to the enormous devastation that it had experienced. Till this very day, every Tisha B'Av at Mincha, we commemorate Yerushalayim, Jerusalem's destruction, with the following prayer. Here again on page one. This is Nachem Hashem Elokeinu. Console Hashem, our God, the mourners of Zion and the mourners of Jerusalem, and that mourning, ruined, humiliated, and desolate city. It is mourning for the loss of her children, and it is ruined, for its dwelling places are in a state of ruin. It is humiliated, for it has lost its glory and is desolate without any to occupy it. It is sitting with its head wrapped out of shame like a barren woman who has not borne children. has been swallowed by the legions and has been inherited by those that serve idols. And whenever travelers would visit those ancient ruins, they would express their grief and tear their clothing, as is stated in the Shulchan Aruch or Achaim, Simon Tov Kuf Samach Aleph, chapter 561, on the top of page 2. One who sees the cities of Yehuda in their ruined state should say, quote, your holy cities are now a wilderness, and then tear their clothing. This is from Isaiah 64:9. And one who sees Jerusalem, Yerushalayim, in its ruined state should say, see, on Zion has become a desolate wilderness, and tear their clothing. After the Roman legions conquered and devastated the city in the year 70 of the Common Era, the 10th Legion made Jerusalem its headquarters adjacent to Migdal David, the remnants of what was originally Herod's citadel or fortress, right near today's Armenian quarter. The remnants of the legion's roof tiles and bricks, emblazoned with the 10th Legion symbol, the wild chazir or boar, the symbol of Edom or Esav, have been found in abundance all over the city. Although at that time Jews were not officially banned from the city, it was no longer a Jewish city, being settled by Syrian and Greek veterans of the legions. To add insult to injury, Jews remaining in Eretz Yisrael, as well as the rest of the Roman Empire, suffered the fiscus Judaicus, the Jew tax. At the same time, however, in Yavne, the study of Torah was still flourishing, first under Rabban Yochanan ben Zakkai, and later under Rabban Gamliel. Although during the 50-year period right after the destruction of the temple, conditions in Eretz Yisrael were somewhat tolerable, conditions became unbearable under the Emperor Hadrian. In his reign, the practice of milah, circumcision, was banned, which led to the aborted revolt led by Bar Kokhba, which left Eretz Yisrael totally decimated. The Roman historian Theo Cassius described the war in the following words, quote, then indeed Hadrian sent against them his best generals. First of these was Julius Severus, who was dispatched from Britain where he was governor against the Jews. Severus did not venture to attack his opponents in the open at any one point, in view of their numbers and their desperation, but by intercepting small groups, thanks to the number of his soldiers and his under officers, and depriving them of food and shutting them up, he was able, rather slowly to be sure, with comparatively little danger, to crush, exhaust, and exterminate them. Just as an aside, you know, you're reminded of Ho Chi Minh's strategy, is how he dealt with the French. And he was able to confine the French to the cities, in the sense that they were finally starved. You know, that was really the fall of the French in Vietnam. We continue on. Very few of them, in fact, survived. 50 of their most important outposts about the Jews and 985 of their most famous villages were razed to the ground. 580,000 men were slain in the various raids and battles, and the number of those that perished by famine, disease, and fire was past finding out. Thus, nearly the whole of Judea was made desolate, end quote. And regarding the fate of Yerushalayim, the church historian Eusebius wrote, quote, Hadrian then commanded that by a legal decree and ordinances, the whole nation should be absolutely prevented from entering from thenceforth even the district round Jerusalem, so that not even from a distance could it be its ancestral home. Ariston of Pella tells the story. He's quoting another historian. Thus, when the city came to be bereft of the nation of the Jews and its ancient inhabitants, had completely perished. It was colonized by foreigners, and the Roman city, which afterwards arose, changed its name and its honor, and in honor of the reigning emperor, Iulius Hadrian, was called Ilia. End quote. And furthermore, Eusebius in his Chronicon wrote, quote, Hadrian's year 20, AD 136, Ilia was founded by Iulius Hadrianus, and before its gate, that of the road by which we go to Bethlehem, he set up an idol of a pig in marble, signifying the subjugation of the Jews to Roman authority. End quote. In addition, during this period, the study of Torah was banned, and eventually the practice of Judaism. In fact, Hadrian changed the name of the province from Judea to Palestine, the home of Jewry's ancient enemies, the Philistines, thus obliterating any remembrance of the Jewish people. The name that Hadrian gave it remained until 1948, and amongst the enemies of the Jews, it still remains. After the death of Hadrian in the year 138, things eased up slightly, as the Hadrianic decrees of forced assimilation were repealed, and the dead who fell in the conquest of Beitar were finally given a burial. The Talmidim, the disciples of Rabbi Akiva who had fled Eretz Yisrael in the wake of the fall of Beitar and the decrees of forced assimilation, finally returned, and Jewish life once again was resumed under the auspices of Rabbi Shimon ben Gamliel, the new Nasi, or the head of the Sanhedrin. Under Rabbi Shimon's son, Rabbi Yehuda HaNasi, and with the support of the Roman Emperor Antoninus, identified by Rav HaGoyin, Rav Isaac HaLevi, as well as other historians, as a philosopher king, Marcus Aurelius, Torah and Eretz Yisrael flourished. It was at that time that the Mishnah received its final editorship. In the post-Mishnaic period, circa the year 200 of the Common Era, the Talmud in Sanhedrin and Chovov Amud Aleph in 26a speaks of severe taxation, so much so that there was a special dispensation given to work the fields on the Shemitah year in order to avoid imprisonment and perhaps death for failure to pay taxes. Yet during all this time, Torah continued to be seriously studied. The discussions of the scholar of that period, which took place mainly in the yeshivas of Tiberia and Caesarea, were preserved for eternity in the Talmud Yerushalmi and much of the Talmud Bavli. Towards the end of the period of the Amoraim, the scholars of Eretz Yisrael, whose discussion and analysis are preserved in the Talmud Yerushalmi, a new challenge arose. As the new emperor of the combined Eastern and Western empires, Constantine, made Christianity the state religion, although at that time paganism had not yet been outlawed, and anti-Jewish legislation permanently became part of Roman law, which they carefully recorded for posterity. Now viewed as the killers of their Lord, the already difficult conditions under which the Jews lived now became increasingly more difficult. To compound all of this, in the year 353, Gallus Caesar, Caesar, a nephew of Constantine and a cousin to Constantine's son and successor, Constantius, conducted a massive and vicious campaign against the Jews of the Galilee, leaving the Galilee a shadow of its former self. For these unwarranted acts of cruelty, Gallus was eventually put to death. It is no wonder then that in the year 359, fearing the eventual disintegration of the Sanhedrin, the High Court in Eretz Yisrael, the Sanhedrin under the leadership of the Nasi Hillel, a descendant of the famous Hillel HaZaken the Elder, fixed permanently the calendar that determines to this day the months, Rosh Chodesh and the Yomim Tovim, the holidays. The only bright spot on this otherwise dark horizon occurred in the year 361, when Constantine's nephew, Flavius Claudius Julianus, or Julian, succeeded his cousin Constantius to the throne. In a short reign of 2 years, Julian, a pagan, who rejected Christianity attempted to reverse the course that was initiated first by the Emperor Hadrian and subsequently by Julian's uncle Constantine. Jerusalem was now officially restored to the Jews under Julian. Julian returned their property, revoked the fiscus Judaeus, the Jew tax, and granted the power of taxation and the title Praetorian Prefect to the Nasi Hillel. He also gave the Jews permission to rebuild the Beis HaMikdash. Unfortunately, he was killed during a military campaign against the Persians, and his Christian successor, Jovian, soon restored all of the original anti-Jewish legislation. Despite all of this, up until the year 415, the descendants of Hillel still continued to lead Jewry and maintain Torah study in Eretz Yisrael, and monies were collected throughout the Roman Empire and sent to Eretz Yisrael to the Nasi to support his efforts. The repeated efforts by the church, however, to undermine the office of the Nasi or Patriarch, and eventually they were successful in abolishing that office entirely. Let me quote you two sources taken from the Code of Theodosius II, the Byzantine emperor who reigned from the year 408 to 450. The first that we're quoting was written in the year 415, and the name of the then current Nasi was Rabban Gamliel, he took the same name as his distinguished ancestors. Who headed the Sanhedrin at one time in Yavne. This is the first, here on page 2. Since the more exalted the office to which he had been raised, the more Gamliel has presumed to disobey our commands with impunity, may your excellence and your power know that our clemency has issued certain commands to illustrious, this is Magister, this is Officiorum, to wit, that the badges of the Patriarch's honorable prefecture to be stripped from him. Likewise, that he be reduced to that rank he held before he was granted prefecture. Furthermore, he may erect no more synagogues, and if any are abandoned, he must destroy those if they can be torn down without rioting. And no Jew shall have the right to judge Christians. If any dispute arises between Jews and Christians, it is to be settled by the governors of the province. If the Patriarch or any other Jew attempts to befoul any Christian or freeman slave of any sect with the mark of a Jew, referring to circumcision, let him and the Jew be subject to the penalty of laws. Also, if any Jew keeps Christian slaves, the slaves are to be freed and placed in the custody of the church according to the law of Constantine. The Emperor Constantine, almost a century before, had already enacted such a law forbidding Jews from owning Christian slaves and granting freedom to any pagan who became a Christian. Now, in a later edict, in the year 429, we find the following. The leaders of the Jews who are nominated by the assemblies of either part of Palestine or spend their time in other provinces must pay whatever funds they have collected under the pretense of pension money after the dissolution of the Patriarchate. As by this time, as in the first one, he had been stripped of special privileges, but he was still in power. By 429, there was no longer recognized the position of Nasi. In the future, under threat of punishment, their ordinary tribute from all of their synagogues, which are patriarchs at one time demanded under the name of Aurum Coronarium, in other words, this is the gold crown, is to be collected by our Palatini, like our officials. In other words, they had supported all the years Jews from all over the realm had given money to support the Nasi, the patriarch. He used that money, of course, to provide for the yeshivas and the bate dinim for the court system. Now this has all come to an end. And all those monies now are to be given to the Roman government. Now we continue. Whatever sum this amounts to, you are to confiscate after a diligent investigation. Those monies which used to be given regularly to the patriarchs from the western provinces are to be confiscated to our charity fund. You can only imagine where that tzedakah went to. By the way, to put things into perspective, during that same time period, as we're speaking between the years 415 and 429, in Bobol, today's Iraq, Rav Ashi and his successors were involved in the composition of the Talmud Bavli, the Babylonian Talmud. Now, despite the efforts of the Byzantine emperors and the church authorities, and after the dissolution of the Patriarchate, the office of the Nasi, Torah study continued to flourish in Eretz Yisrael during this period and beyond, as we see from the following citation, here on page 2. And we start over here in paragraph C. This is a halachic discussion. And it really is, there is, just to preface this, from a cow, goat, sheep, those animals that would normally, that could be offered on the Mizbeach, on the altar, the Torah forbade the eating of chalev, of the fats that surround the stomach area. However, from a kosher chaya, a wild animal, deer, gazelle, that fat is not forbidden. Now, it's clear, if we know there are definitely animals, we know clearly this is a gazelle, or this is a goat. There are other animals discussed in the Talmud, the question, they are wild animals. Do they go follow into the category of the wild animals, or they're perhaps domesticated animals that interbred or whatever, but they're still considered domesticated animals. And that is the question here discussed on the bottom of page 2. Once there was taken out of a karkus goat, evidently there's a special variety, a species of goat, belonging to the Resh Galusa, a basket full of fat, and as referring again to this from the stomach area. Rav Achoy forbade it. He maintained that this animal, even though evidently it was not a standard goat, it was a wild, but it had, its ancestors were domesticated goats. The Rabbi Shmuel, the son of Rabbi Abohu, ate of it and applied to himself the verse, a man's stomach should be filled with the fruit of his mouth. In other words, this is from a verse in Mishlei in Proverbs, that because of his expertise, he was able to have pleasure from this. They sent word from there, Eretz Yisrael, commenting on this argument. Is this specific goat considered a domesticated goat, and therefore you cannot eat from the fats around the stomach area, the chalev, or is it considered a wild animal? It was not descended from domesticated animals, and it therefore would be permitted. So from Eretz Yisrael, evidently the academies of Eretz Yisrael, the scholars of Eretz Yisrael sent, the law accords with Rabbi Shmuel, the son of Rabbi Abohu, that it's permitted. Nevertheless, give heed to the opinion of Rabbi Achoy, for it enlightens the eyes of the exile. So we're dealing with a situation where the Talmud Bavli viewed with great respect the opinion of the scholars of Eretz Yisrael. When did these scholars live? So we have one of the great sources of understanding the history of the Talmud, Mishnaic and Talmudic and post-Talmudic period, is what is known as the Igeris, the letter of Rav Shrira Goyim. Rav Shrira Goyim was from the last of the Goyim. He died circa the year, this is 1006. And he wrote a letter, says at the end of the 10th century, to one of the great Jewish communities of the world, situated in North Africa, not far, which is today's Tunisia, called Keruan. And he wrote to Rabbi Yaakov, whose son later on became the famous Rabbeinu Nissen Goyim. And Rabbi Yaakov was a leading Rosh Hashiva, Dayan, a leading rabbinic scholar in the city, wanted to know about the history of the Torah Shebaal Peh, the history of the oral law. And the result was this very long letter, like a book. very long letter written by Rav Shmuel Gaon, which is using his own Talmudic knowledge plus the records of the Gaonim. He wrote this work. And he writes the following here. It's on the page, top of page 3. Most of the Rabbonin Savaroi, the Rabbonin Savaroi were those who were there were three generations of scholars that succeeded the period of the Amoraim. The Amoraim, according to Isaac Halevi, based on the writings of it's called Rom ben Ibn Duad, this is a leading scholar in Spain, says it came to an end in the year 476. Ravina Ho'achron, the last Ravina, died. But his Talmidim, his disciples, continued on for another three generations. The period of the Gaonim, according to Isaac Halevi, began in the year 589. So this is between 476 and 589, some three generations of scholars. The first generations were the direct Talmidim, disciples of the Amoraim, the teachers of the Talmud. But they called themselves only Rabbonin Savaroi, those who explain. They left the authority of legal decisions to the previous generation. They view themselves only as teachers. They're Savaroi, those who explain. So he writes as follows. Most of the Rabbonin Savaroi, this is of the first generation, died within a relatively short time. This tradition was explained to us by the Gaonim in their chronicles. In the year 504, in the month of Sivan, this is Rabbona Sama Breda Rabbona Yehudoi died. They said he was a judge at the gateway, an official appointed judge. At the beginning of the week, he's taken from the records of the Gaonim. In the beginning of the week, in the fourth of Adar, in the year 506, Rav Achoy Bar Rav Huna died. And you're going to see what seemed to be he is the Rav Achoy referred to in the previous quote. In Nisan of that year, Rav Ruchumi, others changed the text to Rav Ruchumoi, died. Year 506 in Kislev, Rav Shmuel Bar Rav Abohu of Pompadisa died. So it seemed to be that we're dealing in the early 500s, late 400s, that this discussion about this goat of Karkus, Karkuzoi, and yet they needed the approval and the input of the scholars of Eretz Yisrael. So this was very much after, he said, the patriarchate had already come to an end, and yet it seems there were thriving scholarship in Eretz Yisrael. Now, despite the efforts of the Byzantine emperors and the church authorities, and after the dissolution of the Patriarchate, the office of the Nasi, Torah studies, we said, continued to flourish. But yet, you know, it's important despite all of this continuation of Torah study, eventually came to an end. Two generations later, in the year 553, the Jewish community in Eretz Yisrael experienced even greater difficulties as the Byzantine or Eastern Roman Emperor Justinian began issuing harsh anti-Jewish decrees. By the way, the Byzantine Empire is the name given to the remnant of the Roman Empire, which was centered in Byzantium, is the ancient name for the city, which was later changed to Constantinople, and later by the Turks to Istanbul. The official language of the Eastern Roman Empire, which was centered here in Byzantium, was Greek, not Latin. In contrast to the Western Roman Empire, which of course was Latin. And the official religion was the Greek or Eastern Orthodox form of Christianity, in contrast with the Roman Catholic form of Christianity, which was centered in Rome. Now, in the period which is now under discussion, both churches, the Eastern and the Western, were still united. Constantinople had its own patriarch, and Rome had its patriarch. Generally, those who were from Constantinople looked at the patriarch of Rome as perhaps a first amongst equals, but still one of them. The final break between the Eastern Orthodox and the Catholic Church took place during the 11th century. I mean, it was a long period of coming to it, culminating with the mutual excommunication of Pope Leo IX and the Patriarch of Constantinople, Michael Cyrillarius, in the year 1054. Now, there are different, it's interesting, there are different minhogim, so to speak. There are different customs or ways of service that separate the Eastern and the Western churches. For instance, just as a mushel, the Western Church uses for their mass, for their service, they use wafers, matzah. In the Eastern Church, they use chametz. One could say, really, the machlokes is totally, you know, the question. There's two versions of when he was killed. Was he killed on Pesach, or was he killed Erev Pesach? If he was killed on Pesach, and on the first day of Yontif, so therefore the Last Supper, they ate matzah. But if he was killed Erev Pesach, they were finishing up the chametz. Now there is what is known as a uniate, or the what's it, the Eastern the Catholics who are from Eastern Europe and Western Asia, who do have the minhagim, the customs of the Orthodox Church in terms of the Mass, the dating of Easter. However, they have allegiance to the Catholic Church. So the minhagim themselves don't necessarily have to separate them. They tolerate the difference of minhagim. But they do not, the Eastern does not recognize the primacy of the Pope, Patriarch of Rome. Now, returning to the year 553 and the decrees of the Emperor Justinian, I would like to quote from the writings of Simcha Saf, and there's a remarkable work, Tekufas HaGaonim. I quote, it's a translation. Justinian, the Byzantine emperor, proclaimed that it was forbidden for Jews to celebrate the holiday of Pesach before the Christians celebrate Easter. For it was considered a humiliation for Christianity to have Jews first celebrate their holiday. Now, the year that precedes the intercalated year, an Iberior, in other words, this year is going to be an Iberior. There's an extra Ador. But last year was the year before the Iberior. Pesach normally precedes Easter. In those years, the Jews were severely punished for eating matzahs and praying the holiday prayers on Pesach. This is one of Justinian's decrees. In addition, Justinian tried to influence the Jews in the spirit of Christianity by requiring them to publicly translate the Torah to Latin or Greek when it was read in the synagogue on Shabbos. For this purpose, he required the Septuagint, what was then the standard Christian Greek translation, to be used, rather than the Aramaic translation of Onkelos. And special officers were appointed in order to ensure compliance. Now, by the way, in a footnote, Rav Simcha Saf pointed out that that decree had an opposite effect on the Jewish community, as the Greek and Latin languages were, up to that point, had been widely used, became so despised that they fell totally into disuse. You know, it's interesting if you study the Medrash Rabbah, which is a product of Eretz Yisrael, there are many Greek terms. The Oroch, you know, the Sefer Oroch, who was a Rav, a Rosh Hashiva in Rome, explains many of these terms, which are totally unfamiliar to standard students of the Talmud. And it continues on, we also know from other sources that Justinian instituted additional decrees. What's interesting to note, however, is that those decrees were the catalyst for the creation of the whole piyut, a liturgical poetry literature that has enriched our davening and is so much part of our heritage, as we now read on page 3, here on paragraph D, from the Sefer U'itim. The Sefer U'itim was written by Rabbi Yehuda of Barcelona, who flourished in the beginning of the 12th century. And he writes, according to what we have seen written from our rabbis, the piyutim, that the world is accustomed to say, were only instituted at a time of shmad. Now there's novella 146 in the Justinian Code is the one that preserved all of these decrees. Because they were unable to mention words of Torah due to the decree that the enemies imposed on the Jews to forbid the learning of Torah, the sages amongst them instituted the piyutim as part of the prayers in order to mention and alert the common people regarding the laws of the holidays and Shabbos and the minutiae in the forms of praises and thanks and stanzas and poems. So they used the poetry which they allowed, and they inserted all of these halachas, you know, under the watchful eye of the Byzantine officials. In addition, we have another source. After we've discussed this in the past, the Geniza, there was a shul, there was a synagogue in Fustat, this old Cairo, the Ben Ezra synagogue, that had a Geniza, had a attic, which preserved ancient documents. They were put there. The Seamus. There, others had retrieved some of them, but they were largely taken, and the whole thing was emptied by Solomon Schechter, who was a reader of rabbinic literature in Cambridge. And it's just an amazing treasure trove. One of them works written by this Pirkei Ben Baboy, who was a Talmud, a disciple of Rav Hudoi Goin, one of the great Gaonim in the mid-700s. And he writes, if I'm quoting from his Rebbe, Mar Hudoi, of blessed memory, said that they, the Byzantium, decreed Shema on the land of Israel, and they should not recite Shema, and they shouldn't pray. They did let them, however, enter the synagogue to sing Ma'amodais and Piyutim Krovos, that they would say a Maimed, and then would slip in Kedusha and Shema. They did these things only under duress. Now that the Holy One, blessed be He, destroyed the kingdom of Edom and annulled His decrees, and the Arabs came in to let them study Torah, we're going to read this soon, and read Shema and pray, it is forbidden to say anything except that which was originally instituted by our sages of blessed memory. Torah in its place, and poems that describe which is permitted and forbidden in its place, and prayer in its proper place. But you should not interrupt the prayers in the middle to say the piyutim. That was the opinion of the Hudoi Goin. That, of course, was not the standard opinion. Today it's almost a moot point. In most shuls there's very little piyutim said in the middle of davening. On Yom Kippur we maintain some of it. But he said, the origin of this really came from this period of time. Yeah, what?
Spider-Man do not interrupt.
Yeah, yeah. There are different minhagim. We said the Sfardim don't have different minhagim how to deal with the piyutim. Yeah, and all of this, by the way, would seem to support the opinion that the great Python, so it's in scholar Rabbi Lozer Kalir, lived after the Justinian decrees, and most certainly after Pium Tanoim and Amoroyim. But this is a controversial subject about when he lived, which we covered in a previous lecture. There is a source, however, which would indicate that even after these decrees, Torah learning was still being conducted, albeit perhaps clandestinely. And the source is on the bottom of page 3. It says, Marzutra, the son of Marzutra Resh Galusa, went up to the land of Israel. And they elevated him to a position of Resh Pirka. This is like Resh Pirka's Rosh Hashiva. According to Isaac Halevi, this happened right prior to the beginning of the Gaonic period. So the Gaonic period began in the year 589, so it's about 588. He left Babel, he came to Eretz Yisrael, he was under still the Byzantine rule, and yet he became a Rosh Hashiva. But as we say, it's evident, for the most part, though, Jewish life under the Byzantines was extremely difficult. As the church authorities launched numerous campaigns of forced conversion, and yet the Jews continued to remain and maintain their connection to Torah. Scholars point out that during the 6th century, we know of at least 43 Jewish communities in Eretz Israel, 12 towns on the coast, and in the Negev, in the east of the Jordan, 31 is in the Galilee and the Jordan Valley.
Nothing in Yerushalayim at that point.
Doesn't seem so. Finally, in the year 614, Eretz Yisrael, with help from... It seems there was, but it was very difficult. With help from the local Jewish populace, was conquered by the Persians, who were on the whole quite sympathetic to the Jews and allowed them free exercise of their religion. In fact, for 3 years they actually allowed the Jews to rule over Yerushalayim. The period of Persian rule, however, only lasted some 14 years, and in the year 628 the Byzantines reconquered Eretz Yisrael and continued to display all of their earlier antagonism towards the Jews. This period of renewed Byzantine ascendance was short-lived, as a military power unexpectedly arose out of Arabia. Under the reign of Omar, the second caliph, or successor to Muhammad, much of the former Byzantine Empire, as well as the entire Persian Empire, became incorporated into the newly formed Arabic Empire. By the year 636, most of Eretz Yisrael and Syria had already been conquered by the Arabs, and by the year 638, Yerushalayim as well had fallen to the Arabs. This conquest by the Arabs ushered in a new age of tolerance for the Jews, as the new conquerors allowed the Jews to live amongst them and freely practice their religion, as long as they recognized that their status was now to become that of a dehimi, or second-class citizen, and they pay a special tax, the jizya, to the Muslim authorities. The Arab conquest also ushered in a new era of Torah scholarship, as the Torah is now freely studied throughout the length and breadth of Eretz Yisrael, as we now read from the writings of Saul ben Matzliach, a Karaite scholar who was a contemporary of Rav Sadia Gaon, like in the early 900s. Here on page 4. After they, this were the Romans, forsook this place, Jerusalem remained a heap of rocks and an abode for snakes. And as the Jews left, they were forced out by the Romans. No Jew was allowed to come there. Jews who lived in the easterly part of Eretz Yisrael would come together to Mazia. That was the Tiberius, the pro. That was the name they used to for Tveria. Those who lived in the westerly part of Eretz Yisrael would come together to Gaza to pray. No more. Those who lived in the southerly part of Eretz Yisrael would come together to Tzoar to pray. In the days of the small horn, this is Yishmol, and this is a reference and interpretation from the book of Daniel, Daniel, Perek Zion. Hashem opened up the gates of compassion and brought the Jews back to his holy city, where they settled and built buildings in which to read and interpret the Torah, to regularly pray to Hashem, and to establish watches at night. In other words, where they learn. They pray. In this new era, Yerushalayim became a magnet for Jews across the world, all those in need of relief of their suffering, as we now read again from the writings of Saul ben Matzliah, here in page 4, paragraph B. For Jerusalem at this time serves as a city of refuge for every fugitive, and a place of rest for every mourner, and a place of tranquility for every poor or destitute individual. In her midst are those who serve Hashem. People have gathered together from all over, one representative of a city and two from a clan. He's quoting from the Pasuk, Nechad Meir, Shnayim Mishpacha. In her midst are also women who wail and lament the loss of the temple. They do so in the holy tongue, as well as in Persian, as well as Arabic. Eretz Yisrael also seemed to be a magnet for scholars. As Rav Acha of Shavcha, the famed author of the Shiltas, who lived in the middle of the 8th century, also moved there. As we now read from this excerpt from the Igeres of Shuragon. We have it on the bottom of page 4. After him, this is a list of the Gaonim. After him, Rav Natroi Kahana ben Mar, Rav Amuna reigned. He was from Baghdad, from the outer bridge. In his days, Rav Acha of Shavcha went up to the land of Israel. Now he says this was because Rav Natroi had been a close student of his, and when the Reish Galus appointed his student over himself, the master, he left, was the Rav Acha, and went up to the land of Israel. During the period of the Gaonim, there was also a concerted effort, at least on behalf of the, says by the Karoyim, the sect of Jews who denied the Torah Shebaal Peh, the oral law, to settle in Eretz Yisrael. As we now read from a public pronouncement from one of the Karaite sages of the 10th century. This is on top of page 5. Regarding the wretched of the Jewish people who speak amongst themselves and say, quote, it is not incumbent upon us to go to Jerusalem till the time he gathers us up in the same manner as he cast us out. These are the words of those who anger God and are fools. This is from a Karaite scholar. Fortunate is the person who trusts in God and who finds his strength in the ultimate strength. He shouldn't say, how can I go to Jerusalem due to the fear of marauders and thieves? And from whence will I sustain myself in Jerusalem? It is incumbent upon you, my brothers of Israel, to go out of your countries before the evil and confusion of tragedy befall you and your lands. Behold, non-Jewish nations come from the four corners of the world to Jerusalem every month and year because of their fear of God. And you, our Jewish brethren, hearken unto God, arise and come to Jerusalem. And he continues, even if you yourselves don't come, for you lust and pursue your businesses, send from each city 5 people together with their support, so that we should be as one group to continually plead to our God on the mountains of Jerusalem. This letter gives us a further understanding of life there during this period with all of its difficulties. Eventually, Eretz Yisrael became a major center for the Karoyim, who became a major antagonist of the Rabbonim, those who adhered to the traditional rabbinic Judaism, as we will soon see. Because of the many preserved tshuvas and works of the Gaonim of Bavel, their names and accomplishments are well known. Less known, however, are the Gaonim, the Rosh Yeshivas of Eretz Yisrael, during the time of the Gaonim of Bavel. We do make mention of these Torah scholars of Eretz Yisrael, however, every Shabbos, as we say here on page 5 in section 4, paragraph A, we say, Yukum Porkan Min Shemaya, we say, Chinu V'chizda, may redemption arise from heaven, as well as grace, kindness, compassion, long life, abundant sustenance, heavenly assistance, physical health, superior vision, living and spiritually sustained descendants who will neither interrupt nor cease from their involvement in the words of Torah. The Moron of Rabbona Chaburosa Kadishosa Dibarit Yisrael V'Diba Vovel, for our masters and sages, the holy fellowships that are in Eretz Yisrael and in Bavel. But this was evident when this was composed, there were major yeshivas in Eretz Yisrael.
They were eclipsed by the ones in Bavel.
They were eclipsed by the ones in Bavel. It seems that for the most part, the Gaonim of Eretz Yisrael were descendants of certain rabbinic families, as we read here on the bottom of page 5, paragraph B. This is taken from a fragment from the Cairo Geniza. In other words, this was, even though it was relatively well preserved in the because of the lack of humidity, you know, in Cairo. But still, in all, there is not all of it is well preserved. Some, and here it is: Rav Yosef HaKohen Gaon, the son of the sister of Aaron Bar Moshe Ben Meir. This Rav Aaron Bar Moshe Bar Meir was flourished in the early 900s, and it continues on. At the time of this Rav Aaron. The sons of Rav Tzemach HaNossi, the Rosh Yeshiva, had a quarrel. When they put this, in brackets with a question mark, they had to reconstruct this from the fragment, so it's not so clear. They want to say he was from the Rabbonim, this Tzemach. This Tzemach was a position of Gaon for 31 years. His children were pushed out of that position, and the aforementioned Aaron ben Moshe ben Meir was Rosh Yeshiva for 17 years. After him, Rav Yitzchak, his son, was Rosh Yeshiva for 2 years, and then Ben Meir, the brother of the aforementioned Rav Aaron Gaon, was Rosh Yeshiva for 14 years. After him, Avram, the son of Rav Aaron, was Rosh Yeshiva for 7 years. After him, Aaron HaKohen, I guess it's missing from the... After him, Yosef HaKohen ben Ezron with 2 years, and after him, and again, there's ellipse. It says, Yosha ben Ravram ben Rav Aaron for 30 years. And this is, again, a question how to read this. After him, Shmuel Rav Yosef HaKohen. So you see that many of them were related. Regarding the identity of this Rav Tzemach and the reason that his sons were not chosen as the successor, perhaps the following fragment sheds some light. This is on number 2 on page 6. These are the families of the house of David from Tzemach HaNossi. This is from another fragment. One was a list of the Gaonim, the Rosh Yeshivas in Eretz Yisrael. This is really a list of the Karaite leaders. This is from another document. Of David HaMelech from Tzemach HaNossi, the Rosh Yeshiva ben Yosha ben Shol ben Anan ben David. In the lecture we discussed about the Karoyim, Anan ben David was the founder of the sect of the Karoyim. He was a descendant of David HaMelech from the Reish Galusa.
Anan.
And he was overlooked. You know, there would have been position, not of Rosh Yeshiva, he would have been the position of Reish Galusa. He was overlooked because evidently of perhaps certain character flaws. And there was a whole story how he was put into prison, and he got the grace of the caliph, and he went free, and he founded his own version of Judaism. It seems that there were still a very small group of people who did not submit themselves to rabbinic authority. It was a very small, insignificant group. He built it up. And he, of course, had to create his own interpretations, because you just can't look at it without interpreting this. And he formed his own group that eventually grew to be quite large. This it seems this Rav Tzemach was a descendant of his. So perhaps we could understand, even though it seems he was a Rosh Yeshiva, but I can understand his children had sympathies with the Karoyim, and that's why they were pushed out of that position. Again, this is only speculative because of the lack of source material. Now, in a previous lecture, we covered in great detail the controversy between Rav Aaron ben Meir and Rav Sadia Gaon and the Gaon of Mabovel regarding the calendar. This occurred at the end of the first quarter of the 10th century. By all accounts, Rav Aaron was a strong and determined leader, as we witness here in the letter, which we're going to read, which also sheds further light on the relations between the Rabbonim, those who believed in the validity of the Torah Shebaal Peh, the Oral Law, and the Karoyim, those who denied it. Here, as I'm on page 6 in paragraph C, should keep in mind that we've sacrificed our lives for the Jewish people. This is a letter written by Rav Aaron ben Meir. This is our way and the way of our forefathers. Again, the whole letter has not been preserved. The fifth point is we are descendants of Rav Musia, who was killed in the synagogue courtyard by the descendants of Anan, and the descendants of, and we are also, says the descendants, besides Rav Musia, of our father of Meir and Rav Moshe. On many occasions, the enemies desired to kill them, but Shakai, Hashem, acted on their behalf for the sake of his name. The sixth point is, we are part of the community upon which many terrible difficulties have passed, including imprisonment, torture, chaining, and flogging almost to the point of death. And it continues, from the hands of the descendants of Anan, our enemies. We have come for help through, this is a letter sent, says, for help through Hashem, our God, and through you. Act with kindness and reward will be from Hashem. It's not clear to whom he's writing this letter, but evidently it's a cry for help. And we find in a later period, this is written the year 1027, that the time to be cast out of Jerusalem has truly come. If you do not lend any help to the sect of Rabbonim, they will not survive. Yeah, this was written by one of the Gaonim in Eretz Yisrael, of Shlomo ben Yehuda, who was we see from the letters, he is a person whose character was of tremendous heights. Evidently there was a communal quarrel in Fustat, in old Cairo, and he wrote to them. This is again found also in the Cairo Genizim. I wish that someone who was fit and worthy would come and I would put him in my place. I would retire. As it occurred in the earlier generations, that the B'nai B'Serah gave up their position to Hillel. And then he continues, he was the master of sheep, of the people of Israel, should establish shepherds for them that he deems worthy so they can guide them with knowledge and understanding. And again, another letter, our brethren, is incumbent upon us to remove jealousy from our midst and hatred from our souls. Continues on, behold, we have but one Father. Did he not create all of us? It is sufficient for us to have the hatred of the Gentiles, our enemies who desire to destroy our souls. Do we have to consume the flesh of our own arms? As this is he's writing, evidently response to contention within the Jewish community. And then he writes another letter, my whole desire and wish is for peace amongst Jews. It is revealed to God that if money would be sent to the yeshiva, that would have been the product of communal strife, I would not take it. Because I don't want to take money that comes from such a community. Although very little has been preserved of the correspondence from the communities of the Gola, the diaspora, to the yeshiva in Eretz Yisrael, the following gives us an idea of the esteem in which they were held. And this is really taken from the Tkuvos HaGoyim or Simcha Asaf. And this was to the community of the Rhine. This is really, he's paraphrasing this. The community of the Rhine asked the yeshiva of the land of Eretz Yisrael in the year 960 to reply about a report that they had heard about the coming of Mashiach, also about the status of a sircha to the heart. In other words, it's a lesion from the lungs to the heart, about its kashrus. The response, regarding the coming Mashiach, you are not worthy of receiving an answer. Don't you believe in the words of the sages and the signs that they predicted? The signs have not materialized. You know, Mashiach hasn't, this is not the time for his coming. Regarding a sircha to the heart, it says, we who are the major Sanhedrin, the minor Sanhedrin of the land of Israel, eat an animal with such a sircha. He says it's kosher. And he quotes Rav Yaakov ben Mardechai, the Rashiv of Sura, who lived, you know, some years, 150 years before. And all of his generation signed a letter allowing a sircha to the heart. And then Rav Simcha Asaf continues on. They also wrote the Rhine community. This is the, it would be better to have, they had written them questions regarding the profundities of the tractates of Yevomus and Erevin rather than simple questions. They ended with the greetings of peace. This is for those like the Rhine communities who inquire of their welfare. After this, at that period of time, the communities of the Rhine were still in their infancy. The major centers had not reached Germany yet. It was only later on, it says that in the year 1000, Rabbeinu Gershon, his colleagues, that Germany really began to become a major, major center. But there were, as we say, just a quote here on page 8. First on paragraph F, this was a letter from Rav Haigam, which would seem commenting, complaining. This was a period that the influence of the yeshivas in Bobel was waning. And he was writing to the community of Keruan about those who had asked them, who had corresponded previously to them, who were no longer corresponding to the yeshivas in Bobel. It is after we sent the correspondence, they stopped sending us their letters, for they have subordinated themselves to a group of scholars in the land of Israel. We don't know what has become of our correspondence to them. Please inform us whether it reached them in order to set our minds at rest. If not, we will send them a copy of our original letter. But as we see, that there was a flourishing yeshivas in Eretz Yisrael. That's really what I want to point out during this whole period. And I just quote here on paragraph G that they found from the, even though it was a fragment, but there began, the heading is, this is a list of the scholars of Israel, the rabbis and the heads of the rabbinical courts who led the people of the Lord of hosts until the glory of the great, holy, prestigious diadem of beauty of our master and rabbi, our beloved, our Gaon Avraham, the Rosh Hashiva of Gaon Yaakov. But during this period of time, they had a list that it's not clear, we don't have the list, but many, many years. Just as an aside, and again, you could read this yourself, during this period, not only was there, this period of time in Eretz Yisrael, not only was there rabbinic scholarship, but there was biblical scholarship. This was the period of time of the Bali Masorah, those who worked to find the exact corrected version of Tanakh. And it was really, it was that that version that the Rambam, as you can read the quotes here, the Rambam himself on the top of page 9, quote, says, "Because I have seen great errors in all of the Sforim regarding these things, just as the Bali Masoros, as those who are the masters of the tradition, who write and compose works, in the forms of Apsuchas and Stumos, those parts of the, you know, that they're sections of the Torah that are separated by some spaces. Some spaces are called Pesuchos, and some are called Stumos, open or closed. And there's really a difference of opinion how to understand this. According to the Rambam, there has to be a minimum space between sections, whatever it is, of 9 letters. This is based on the Talmud. If after the break, 9 letters, there is the new section begins in the beginning of the line, it's called Psuchos. If it begins in the middle of a line, it's called Stumos. That's the Rambam's definition. But he says that there are differences of opinions based upon the variant versions of the Sforim upon which they rely on. I have seen to it to write out all the parshas of the Torah, the sections, the Psuchos and Stumos, and there's the spacing, which is called open or closed, and the form of the songs. This is in order to fix all of the Sforim and correct them. The Sefer upon which we're relying regarding these things is the well-known Sefer in Egypt, which includes all 24 Sforim. This was the original Sefer, which was composed in Eretz Yisrael during the 900s. The Sefer used to be in Jerusalem for many years and was used as a model to correct all of the other Sforim. Everyone relied upon it because Ben Osher had corrected this Sefer and carefully read through it over a period of many years and corrected many times over. This is in the 10th century. And it was this Sefer that I relied upon when I personally wrote a Sefer Torah according to Halacha. This, it seems that this Sefer, so to speak, of Ben Osher eventually made its way to Aleppo. And this was the famed Aleppo Codex. I mean, that itself deserves a shir in itself, and the time doesn't allow. But it was preserved in its entirety, at least until the year 1947, when the Arab riots came. And it was transported to Eretz Yisrael, and it is today missing a large section of the Torah, from the Torah itself. And that's a whole story in itself, and books have been written about what happened to this. Those who are writing books and claim this conspiracy is that it was it left Syria in its entirety, and it came to Eretz Yisrael in its entirety, and somewhere on the line someone took this, and that's a subject of a great controversy which is beyond this. According to scholars from at least the 4th century and on, even non-Jews would often make the difficult trip to Eretz Yisrael to pray and visit the sacred places mentioned in the Bible. The first written record of such a visit was recorded by a Christian who started his trip from the city of Bordeaux in France in the year 333 of the Common Era. Less than a decade before, the Emperor Constantine had declared Christianity to have a central and honored place in the Roman Empire. And it convened together, says the leading Christian theologians in the city of Nicaea, in northwest Asia Minor, in what is today's Turkey, to set up the foundation for Orthodox Christian belief and practice, which you discussed this in the previous lecture. And it sent his mother, the Empress Helena, to Jerusalem to begin a building campaign in order to make the newly renovated Jerusalem a center of Christianity. The following is an excerpt from the Bordeaux pilgrim's account of his pilgrimage here. And this is on page 9. And he said, "In the building itself where the temple stood, which Solomon built, they say that the blood of Zacharias," he didn't see it himself, he's quoting the story, "which was shed upon the stone pavement before the altar remains to this day." I mean, it is discussed in the Agadata and the Gemara, In the Gemara in Gittin, in the Zion of Mbeis, and Sanhedrin Sarevav Mbeis, about the blood of Zechariah. But he claims this, at least the story, that it was still there. Zechariah was the son of Yehoyada. He was the Kohen Gadol. He was a high priest. He was a Navi. He rebuked the people and they killed him.
In the Beis
HaMikdash. And the Gemara, and the Agadata, and the Gemara describes of his blood still being there, or bubbling out, or whatever. Says at the time of the Churban, of the destruction of the first Beis HaMikdash. Here he's describing it still there in the year 333. At least he heard about this. All around you can see the marks of the hobnails of the soldiers who killed him, as plainly as they had been pressed into wax. Now, in the Beis HaMikdash, one is not allowed to walk with hobnails. And I'm sure that those who killed him did not have shoes on as they walked in the Beis HaMikdash. But we're continuing on. There are two statues of Hadrian. And not far from the statues, there's a perforated stone to which the Jews come every year and anoint it and bewail themselves with groans, rend their garments, and so depart. There also is the house of Chizkiah, king of Yehuda. He was describing, he went as a tourist, and that must have been, this is what his guide told him. Within, however, the walls of Sion is seen the place that was David's palace. Of the seven synagogues that once were there, only one remains. The rest are plowed over and sown upon, as said Isaiah the prophet. Or it's from Micha. Now, the Bordeaux Pilgrims account is actually the only historical source for our knowledge of Jewish life in Jerusalem during this period. Evidently, Jews were allowed to have a synagogue in the area of what was already called then Har Tzion, Mount Zion, which is really the western part of the Old City. Not to be confused with the original Har Tzion, which was either referring to Har Abayis, the Temple Mount, the site of the Beis HaMikdash, which we say V'sech Zeno Einenu V'shuv Kol Tzion V'rachamim, says that the Shechina should come back to Tzion, or to the area south of the Temple Mount, the original Ir David, the city of King David, the seat of David's government, which was totally decimated at the time of destruction of Yerushalayim, is only now being excavated. Now the location of the perforated stone, you know, which he describes, that there's the Jews come every year to anoint it, which they understand to be referring to Tisha B'av, and they allow the Jews to come once a year to this perforated stone, is not clear. Since, according to Rabbeinu Osher, the Rosh, in his commentary to the Tractate Chulin, the Efer Porah, the remnants of the ashes of the red heifer, were still in existence during this period, the year 333, it was still in existence. It is possible that the Jews who were Tohar, ritually purified through the use of the ashes, could have actually entered the temple precinct. Now the Kodesh HaKadoshim, the Holy of Holies, was still off limits for any Jew. But if the stone of the Bordeaux pilgrim account is one and the same as the Sakhra, which was later covered with a special dome shrine, you know, this is the Dome of the Rock, by the Caliph Abd al-Malik in the year 691, then in all likelihood, it is the place of the Mizbeach, the altar, rather than the Evan Shasia, the foundation stone of the Kodesh HaKadoshim, the Holy of Holies. If so, perhaps Kohanim priests would have entered the area near the altar, as a non-Kohen is normally not allowed beyond the Ezra's Yisroel, the first 11 Amos cubits of the eastern part of the temple courtyard. So there, it is possible that if Kohanim, who were Tohor, who ritually could have gone to that stone. Now, over 800 years passed between the account of the Bordeaux pilgrim and the account of Rav Binyamin of Tudela, Spain. Although there are other travelogues written after the Bordeaux pilgrim, unfortunately none of them gives us information regarding the Jewish community. We discussed briefly the history up until the conquest of the Arabs and the fall of the Byzantines in Eretz Yisrael, but the Arabian period itself was full of difficulty. Besides massive and devastating earthquakes in the year 1033 and again in the year 1067, which totally destroyed the city of Ramla and wreaked terrible damage in Jerusalem and caused untold deaths, Eretz Yisrael was often a battleground between warring factions, especially during the 131 years between the Fatimid, or Egyptian conquest of Eretz Yisrael, and the conquests under the Crusaders. The Fatimids, recognized as their sole spiritual leaders the descendants of Muhammad's daughter Fatima. This, by the way, is which devised the Sunnis, the main branch of Islam, and the Shiites, or the Shi'at Ali, the followers of Ali's descendants. Ali was Fatima's husband. Now, we're familiar with the Shiites who were in Iran. And the majority of those in Iraq are Shiites. The branch of Shiites in North Africa claimed this descent from Ismail, the seventh in the line of Ali. Hence, they were called Ismailis. In the year 969, this branch of Shiites conquered Egypt and then went on to conquer Eretz Yisrael in Syria. Initially, these new rulers displayed increased tolerance to the Jews and employed Jews as their physician and advisors, such as Rabbi Paltiel, who was the advisor of the Caliph Mu'iz and his successor Aziz. It was due to his influence and that of Menachem ben Avram ben Al-Kazaz, the official tax collector of Eretz Yisrael in Syria, the Fatimid government supported the Gaonim and the Yeshivas of Eretz Yisrael. They actually were supported by them during that period. This all came to an end, however, when Aziz died and his son, who was 11 at the time, Hakim, eventually came to power. He was clearly imbalanced. As one historian put it, I'm quoting, he ordered the killing of all the dogs in Egypt, followed by all of the cats. He forbade the eating of grapes, watercress, and fish without scales. He slept by day and worked at night, ordering all Cairoans, the inhabitants of Cairo, the seat of his government, to do likewise. You think you have it bad. In 1004, again, he ordered Jews to wear a wooden cow necklace to remind them of the golden calf and bells to alert Muslims of their approach. And he continues on, Jews were forced to choose between conversion or leaving the country. Synagogues were destroyed in Egypt and Jerusalem. He continues on, he burned the Jewish quarter in Cairo. The caliph's antics convinced some Ismailis that Hakim had personified God within him. In the frenzy of his own holy revelations, Hakim did not discourage this new religion and started to persecute Muslims. He banned Ramadan and terrorized Shiites as well as Sunnis. He became so hated by the Muslims that he needed the support of the Christians and Jews in Cairo, whom he allowed to rebuild their synagogues and churches. By this time, the psychopathic caliph was wandering in trances through the streets of Cairo, often heavily medicated by doctors. Hakim purged his court, ordering the killing of his own tutors, judges, poets, cooks, and cousins, and the cutting off the hands of the female slaves, often himself playing the butcher. Finally, in the middle of one night in February 1021, the demented caliph, still only 36 years old, rode out of Cairo into the hills and vanished so mysteriously that his devotees were convinced, quote, Hakim was not born of woman and did not die. Since his donkey and some bloodied rags were discovered, he had probably been murdered by his sister, who arranged the succession of his little son Zahir. Hakim's devotees were slaughtered by Fatimid troops, but a few escaped to found a new sect which survives to this day as the Druze of Lebanon. If you were thinking about becoming a Druze. Yeah. This is a quote from the book Jerusalem Biography by Simon Sebag Montefiore. Now you can imagine how life was during this period. During the years between 1015 and 1020, the yeshiva in Jerusalem moved to Ramla. Some theorize, such as Rav Simcha Sop, that it was due to difficulties dealing with the Karaites, which we do have record from the writings preserved in the Geniza. It is quite possible it was also due to life under Hakim. Although under Hakim's successor Zahir, life returned back to normal, and Zahir's successor Mustansir was strongly influenced by his Karaite Jewish advisor Abu Sayyid al-Tustari, and as a whole was much more sympathetic to the Jews, the yeshivas now struggled for support. That's because before Hakim had been supported by the government. In a fundraising letter by the Gaon, the Rosh Yeshiva Yoshua, he wrote, quote, "You should be aware that we're only coming to you now because of extreme duress. In former times, when the government supported us, we wouldn't have put such a burden upon you." End quote. By the way, when Abu Sayyid al-Tustari died, and this was the Karaite Jewish advisor, in the year 1048, he was eulogized by the Gaon, the Rosh Yeshiva. Evidently, though he was a Karaite, he was sympathetic to all of the Jews. The Fatimid rulership over Eretz Yisrael only lasted until year 1071. It was in that year that the Seljuks, originally nomadic Turkish warriors, who had taken over the Baghdad Caliphate in 1055, after defeating the Byzantines in the Battle of Manzikert, came south to Eretz Yisrael to challenge the rule of the Fatimids. The Gaon and the Yeshiva fled to the city of Tyre in Lebanon and continued their studies there. In 1073, Yerushalayim fell to the Seljuks, who ravaged Jerusalem. But the suffering had not come to an end. Because of the precarious situation under the Seljuks, the Christian pilgrims were being harassed by them, and this finally led to a decision by Pope Urban II, this is in 1095, to declare a holy war crusade to take back Yerushalayim to become once again a Christian stronghold. Thus, in the year 1099, after a prolonged siege, Yerushalayim fell to the Crusaders, who mercilessly beheaded and hacked to death the vast majority of its inhabitants, men, women, and children. The stench of the rotted bodies, even after there was somewhat of a cleanup and burial, lasted for at least 6 months. One observer, Fulker of Chartres, wrote, quote, "Oh, what a stench that was around the walls, within and without, from the rotting bodies of the Saracens, lying wherever they had been hunted down," end quote. After reading the accounts of the slaughter, you get a somewhat different view of those chivalrous knights who fought for the glory of God. Many of the Jews of Yerushalayim sought refuge in their synagogues, but they were burnt to death together with their synagogues, something that occurred almost 850 years later by the Nazis, Yimach Shemam. The remaining Jews and some 300 Sforim, Hebrew books, including the Codex of Ben Osher, as we quoted before, that would later be preserved by the community of Aleppo, the famed Aleppo Codex, were ransomed by the Jews of Egypt. The Crusaders took over the Muslim sanctuaries, the Al-Aqsa Mosque, which became the royal palace of the new king of Jerusalem, King Baldwin I. And the Dome of the Rock now became known as Templum Domini, the Temple of the Lord, with a cross placed at its top. As the Crusader army was coming close to Tyre, on their way to Jerusalem, the Gaon, the Rosh Yeshiva, and his yeshiva moved to a suburb of Damascus, Chadrach, and later to Damascus itself. They still consider themselves to be the yeshiva of Eretz Yisrael. So really, during this time and afterwards, there was really no yeshiva in Eretz Yisrael. The Crusader presence was felt not only in Eretz Yisrael, but as far north as Antioch and in Armenia. And as far east as the county of Edessa, which straddles the Euphrates in what is today southeast Turkey. All in all, four crusader states were formed. The Kingdom of Jerusalem, the county of Tripoli, what is now Lebanon, the Principality of Antioch, was today southern Turkey, and again, the county of Edessa, which is in southeast Turkey. But the crusaders were constantly battling the Muslims who were bent upon recapturing their territory. By the year 1244, the year 1244 marks the beginning of the end of the crusader occupation of the Middle East. As Zangi, the Atabeg, or ruler of Mosul and Aleppo, in today's Iraq and Syria, captured Edessa, killing all the male crusaders or Franks, as they were known, and selling the female Franks into slavery. Shortly afterwards, Zangi was assassinated by one of his eunuchs, and his 28-year-old son Nur el-Din took over from his father and began putting relentless pressure on the rest of the crusader states. As a result, the Pope called for a second crusade, which ended in total failure. Despite all his effort, though, by the time Nur al-Din died in the year 1174, the Kingdom of Jerusalem, the County of Tripoli, and the Principality of Antioch were still in the hands of the crusaders. What he did accomplish, however, was the capture of Damascus and the defeat of the Fatimids in Egypt. Now that the yeshiva and Eretz actually moved to Syria, what became of what was originally the spiritual intellectual status of the Jews in Eretz Yisrael? We have to realize there was Gaonim in Eretz Yisrael. There had been yeshivas. Questions were sent to them from outlying communities, from the Rhine, from Keruan. Now they had moved. They moved first to Tyre, to Damascus. What was left in Eretz Yisrael? And also, in addition, what effect, if any, did the arrival of immigrants have on their own customs? You know, immigrants brought their own customs. How did it affect the customs of those who had lived in Eretz Yisrael for all these years? Because of time, I just would like to just summarize, and you can look in the notes yourself. There happens to be a machlokas question about how many days in Eretz Yisrael should the Jews commemorate Rosh Hashanah. We know as a fact today they commemorate 2 days, Rosh Hashanah. And this is based on the teachings of Rabbeinu Yitzhak Alfasi, who understood that just in Eretz Yisrael, only the ones who kept 1 day of Rosh Hashanah are those who were there where the Sanhedrin was. If you lived outside of there, if I lived in the Sanhedrin, is, for instance, in Yerushalayim, I'm in Haifa, I'm not going to know if there's going to be, the only time I'm going to know if there's going to be a second day of Rosh Hashanah is later on in the second day. So for all practical purposes, there are 2 days every place in Eretz Yisrael, which is not in walking distance of the place where the Beis Din is. As a result, since we no longer have a Beis Din in Eretz Yisrael, the Rif maintained that it's 2 days in all of Eretz Yisrael. But the minhag in Eretz Yisrael, and this is why I quote over here, and from a letter from Rav Haigoin, was only 1 day. All the years they only kept 1 day Rosh Hashanah. And Rav Zrachi Alevi writes, when the Jews from Provence, from southern France, immigrated to Eretz Yisrael, they brought with them the psakim of the Rabbeinu Yitzhak Alfasi. That's when they began to keep 2 days. And there's a question, well, if that's the case, maybe they should only keep 1 day, as the original psak was 1 day. So Zerachi Alevi argues it should be 1 day. The Ramban, who comes to the defense of the Rabbeinu Yitzhak Alfasi, maintained it should be 2 days like the Rif. And even though the minhag in Eretz Yisrael was 1 day, they were not learned in Eretz Yisrael. At that time, the Geniza wasn't discovered. They didn't find the record of the Gaonim in Eretz Yisroel. And the Ramban maintained, it's just before the discovery of Geniza, Eretz Yisroel was a backwater. Bubble was the place, not Eretz Yisroel. Had the Ramban been aware of the amount of scholarship in Eretz Yisroel, perhaps he would have viewed this differently. But it maintained the minig was really a minig, the custom of people who were unlearned. So really this is what was the status, how do we view the status of the Jews in Eretz Yisroel? La halacha, we follow the ruling of the Rabbi Yitzchak Alfasi, the Rif, Jews in Eretz Yisroel to this day keep 2 days. But it's important to realize that was not always the case. It's interesting, you can look yourself, the Rambam, when he was escaping from the forced conversion of what was in Morocco, he originally came to Eretz Yisroel. It was very difficult to remain Eretz Yisroel. It was in the year 1165. There were tremendous contention over here between Nur al-Adin, says the Muslims, and the Christians and the Crusaders. They were still in control. He left and he came to Egypt. But he describes, there are different where he describes life in Eretz Yisroel. And he, at one point, he explains that he views the traditions of those in Eretz Yisroel with great respect. You can see, on the other hand, he would realize when he came, already there was a dearth of scholarship. It was 1165. The yeshiva had not been there for many, many years already. And he writes, he's on page 11, number 4, I've seen men in Eretz Yisroel with a title of Chaverim. They're called Chaverim. The rabbinic colleagues. Another place I've seen someone who's called Rosh Yeshiva. These people don't even qualify to be called a student who studies for a day. Barbe Rab de Chadyon. He was really felt that it was not, when he came, it was not a place of scholarship. Even though he views the traditions that were traditions that came for many generations with great respect. I would just like to end here with a letter which was written by the Rambam describing his trip to Eretz Yisroel. And it's full of, you see the religious sentiments of the Rambam in this letter, perhaps more than any of his works. On the night of the first day of the week, this is Matzoy Shabbos, Saturday night, on the 4th of the month of Iyar, I began my voyage on the Mediterranean Sea. On Shabbos, the 10th of Iyar, 4925, the year of creation, this would be in the year 1165, a giant wave came and was about to sink our ship, and the sea was very turbulent. I made a vow then that I would fast those 2 days and would follow all of the strictures that apply to a genuine public fast. This would apply to myself as well as the members of my household, all of the extended household. I commanded my son to do so. He and all of his descendants forever, they should give tzedakah, charity on that day to the extent of their ability. Part of my vow was that I would sit in solitude on the 10th of Iyar and just pray and study the entire day all by myself. Just as on that day when I was all alone, with the exception of the Holy One, blessed be He, so too I made a vow that I wouldn't see any person, wouldn't sit with anyone else except in an emergency situation. He viewed basically he was close to death. On the night of the first day of the week, Masoy Shabbos, on the 3rd of the month of Sivan, I disembarked at Acre, and I was finally saved from the Shema, the forced conversion, which was in North Africa, and we reached Eretz Yisroel. On that day, I made a vow that I would commemorate that day as a day of joy and happiness, festivities, literally drinking mishta and gifts to the poor. I and my household for all generations. On the third day of the week, Tuesday, the 4th of Mar Cheshman, from creation, we left Akko to go up to Yerushalayim, which was fraught with danger. Even though he came in Sivan, He did not go until Marcheshvan, after Rosh Hashanah, he did not leave. I entered as fraught with danger, because it was a time of war. I entered the great and holy house and prayed there on the fifth day, on the sixth of Marcheshvan. It's not clear what the holy house is. On the first of the week, did he go to the Al-Aqsa Mosque? And there's a question if that really is outside of the original Harabayas, so one would be allowed. But on the other hand, it was a Christian church. He wouldn't have really gone into a church.
What is the Holy House?
Yeah, what is the Holy House? Is it Beis HaKnesset? It's just not clear. On the first of the week, because it was a Christian city, and it was not a place for Jews. On the first of the week, on the ninth of Marcheshvan, I left Jerusalem to go to Hebron, to kiss the graves of my forefathers in the cave, in the catacomb. That day, he went to Moras HaMachpelah. That day I stood by in the cave and prayed and gave praise to the Almighty, may be blessed for everything. Those 2 days, the sixth and ninth of Marcheshvan, I made a vow to be a holiday with prayer and outpouring of joy to Hashem with eating and drinking. And Hashem continued to help me in all of my endeavors, and may the verse, says, Dora Shalom, I will satisfy my vows, be fulfilled through me. Amen. Just I merited to pray there in its ruined state, so too may I and all of Israel speedily merit to see its consolation. And he describes in another letter someone who accompanied him. Myself, my brother, my father, blessed memory, and you, Rabbi Yefes, all four of us went to the house of Hashem in trembling. And we traveled together seeking Hashem in deserts and forests. I will not forget this. Yeah, this is describing another letter, his trip, that trip that he made to Yerushalayim. It's not clear. Just not clear. Now, at this general time, says that the Rambam writes of his travels, other travelers visit Eretz Yisrael and continue to do so throughout the ages. Description of life during that period written by these travelers will be subject of our next lecture.